Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we've heard from all three candidates in the race for Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Now we'll talk some about the politics of the court race and the role of the court in Wisconsin politics and government. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts on the candidates. You've heard all three of them Tuesday and today. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Tim Dale joins us now. He's assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's just start off with the broad strokes. What are your thoughts on the race for the Supreme Court so far?
Well, so far, a couple of things are striking. I think every time we have a Supreme Court race, we have a conversation about the politicization of the court. Mm-hmm. And so we may want to talk a little bit more about that. I think for a lot of people, this primary especially is going under the radar. We had so much attention paid to the Prosser-Klopfenberg race last year. I'm not sure if it's election fatigue or if people are just worried about other things, but we haven't seen too much attention paid to this race, and one of the evidences of that is that these candidates really aren't raising a lot of money at this stage in the campaign. I think we may see more money come into the race after the primary, but right now I think it's striking for how much this race matters for the balance of the court. We really aren't seeing that much attention paid to it.
Well, let's look at the politicization first. As you mentioned, it seems like it maybe reached its peak in that Prosser-Klopfenberg race, where really the candidates were seen as proxies for or against Governor Walker in the protests over Act 10. Are we ever going to, well, I won't say ever, but is it likely that we'll see a court race that politicized again in the near future?
Well, I don't know. It's an interesting question because I'm not sure we saw anything more politicized than we saw basically everything in Wisconsin last year. And so we can, I think the easy answer to that question would be it's hard to imagine anything being more politicized. I think that having an election for a court raises a lot of issues related to the question of politicization of the court. So, of course, the court is supposed to be nonpartisan, which is why this is a nonpartisan race. But anytime the court makes a major decision on an area of policy, that decision is going to reflect what most perceive as policy preferences, even if the decision is written in a way that reflects interpretation of the law. So I think that while we probably won't see what we saw with Prosser and Klopfenberg, as your last guest showed us, this really is a race that becomes about policy, even when the design of the Wisconsin Constitution was intended to avoid it.
Now, there's a lot of reporting saying and accusations that incumbent Pat Rogensack is part of a conservative or Republican 4-3 majority. There's talk that Ed Falone is, in effect, a Democrat who would flip it the other way. And then there's talk from the candidate himself, Vince Megna, saying he is a Democrat. Is it wrong for us in the media and us as voters to try to pin partisan labels on the candidates?
Well, the empirical question is no, in the sense that we've seen the court decide along what we consider to be partisan lines. I think the complicating factor for this is that when Supreme Courts issue decisions, when judges at any level issue decisions, these decisions are matters of technicalities of law. So even if a judge decides that a policy is a bad idea, the justification for judges' decisions are always rooted in interpretations of the law. Now, there are also partisan divisions about how laws should be interpreted. For example, the power of an executive in a state, so how much power the governor should have. That can become a partisan issue, obviously, because the governor is partisan, no matter what party the governor is affiliated with. And so when a court is split on an issue like executive authority, that is perceived, rightly or wrongly, as a political decision, even if that decision is rooted in an interpretation of the powers of governor, broadly speaking.
Well, there's this ideal, or it seems to me there's this ideal that if I'm a judge, I look at the law, I consider the law, and I base my decision on that. There's a perception that it's the opposite, that I have my political reaction, my partisan reaction, I know the end result I want, and then I just, you know, fish around in the law for a while until I find the justification for the result I want. How do we split the difference? Is my ideal situation there a fantasy?
Well, I think that's a big question for any court, and I think we see the same debates about the U.S. Supreme Court. I think it's actually probably a mix, although any judge anywhere will tell you that the latter is not what they do. I think the reason that it seems that way, it seems like judges are looking for a way to justify a decision, is that the details of the cases become so complex, and the details are related to a specific case. Judges aren't making a decision thinking about, or aren't supposed to be making a decision thinking about, broader questions or issues. They're deciding about a particular case. That all of those interpretations, when they're all combined, it ultimately appear like a political decision. But I think that the bigger issue is the election of judges. The reason why judges are appointed at the national level, at the federal level, is because judges are supposed to be a check on the other branches of government as an independent judiciary, not a check on the other branches of government as an elected body. And so in Wisconsin, I think we see this kind of unusual politics of the judiciary because we have a popularly elected court. And so we end up with this question about whether the court should reflect public opinion or should reflect partisan opinion. And ultimately, the election of a court means that we have to have these conversations even more explicitly than we do at the federal level.
Rob Ferret talking to Tim Dale. He's a political scientist at UW-La Crosse. We're looking at Wisconsin's state Supreme Court election. There's a primary February 19th. It features incumbent Pat Rogensack, challenger law professor Ed Filone, and Lemon Law attorney Vince Megna. You can join with your thoughts, your observations, and your questions about how it works and why we elect judges in the first place. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Well, in our last half hour, we heard Vince Megna talk about one of his challenges to his opponents to refuse to take out-of-state money. Let's hear their responses. They addressed that question when they were on the air with us on Tuesday. First, here's Ed Filone.
If money is going to be involved, the question is not where it comes from. The question is transparency and the donations being disclosed so that the public can see where the money is coming from. That's the key.
And then here's Pat Rogensack.
I am not going to take Mr. Megna up on his challenge this time. I tried that last time, and it really didn't work.
And she went on to say that in a previous campaign, she had refused some money. Her opponent didn't. She felt it put her at a pretty big disadvantage, though she ended up winning. So what do you think of that challenge from Vince Megna? Is that grandstanding, or is there some substance to it, Tim?
Well, I think there's substance to it only in the sense that it seems like, in principle, we should be running a Supreme Court race in Wisconsin with Supreme Court of Wisconsin interests, meaning money coming from inside the state. But the justice is correct that whenever a candidate refuses to take certain money, that it puts them at a competitive disadvantage. In this case, getting a message out there to an electorate that needs to hear about these candidates is going to be play a significant role in who wins the race. And so I think while there's a principle that is there for not accepting money, there actually would be a principle for not accepting money at all, for example, in a Supreme Court race. Why would anybody have an interest in seeing one candidate or another in an independent judiciary elected? I think the practicality of it is that campaigns cost money. And so I think it is. It becomes a difficulty refusing money. And so typically the people who call for refusing money are the ones who are going to be at a disadvantage anyway and would like to see the playing field level.
There have been efforts to change the law, the laws about campaign finance in general, but about court races in particular, including efforts for that impartial justice bill a while back. Has anything really changed much as far as the financing of court elections?
No, it hasn't. And part of the reason for this is that there needs to be a kind of energy behind it. And ironically, there has to be an energy that depends on candidates really running on this issue. But it turns out that it's not a big fundraising issue to tell people that you don't want their money. The reason that people give money to campaigns is that they want to have an influence on what happens in politics. So we see this at the national level as well, that as difficult as it is to get traction on campaign finance, you also have all sorts of legal questions about campaign finance. And as we saw in the recent United States Supreme Court case, the Citizens United decision, the federal court sees campaign contributions as an expression of freedom of speech. So Even if we saw some sort of action on it, there is a broader conversation that we're having in the United States about campaign finance that is one that's ongoing.
And then there have been calls, and I don't think there's a lot of traction on this in Wisconsin, but calls, say, from the editorial board of the Wisconsin State Journal saying, we need to get rid of these elections. We need to have merit appointments of judges. Do you see any support for that beyond the editorial board?
I don't necessarily see support for that. In Wisconsin, in particular, there is a real lowercase d democratic impulse to elect people. We want state officials, including judges, we want them elected in Wisconsin, and that's a kind of a fundamental part of what we do in Wisconsin, our identity. But the editorial board actually makes really good points in terms of political philosophy. We have an independent judiciary because we want an independent check on the elected branches of government. So while philosophically the editorial board and those who teach in college classrooms would say that James Madison was correct in the Federalist Papers that we want an independent judiciary, it's unlikely, at least in the foreseeable future, that we would see that change in Wisconsin, as far as I can see.
That's political scientist Tim Dale with the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. We're talking about Wisconsin's Supreme Court election, just 12 days till the primary. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions, and we'll get to your calls in just a couple minutes. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good chance of freezing drizzle or a mix of snow and freezing drizzle around the state this morning. Winter weather advisory in effect until 6 p.m. today. Could make driving a little dicey, only up to an inch of snow in some places, but the freezing rain could leave about a tenth of an inch of ice on the roads. Temperature-wise, highs 25 to 35 around the state. Skies clearing tonight with lows mainly in the teens. Coming up next hour, the dark side of the personal finance industry. A lot of the national gurus we turn to for advice may be steering us wrong and covering up more fundamental problems with how our economy works. That's according to my guest next hour, the author of Pound Foolish. This hour, we're talking about Wisconsin's state Supreme Court race, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Tim Dale is our guest. He's a professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Spike is with us in River West. Hi, Spike.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking the call. I guess, Tim, the question that I have, you know, you talked about the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the checks and balances there. But you had the case with the open meetings law where the judicial branch told the legislative branch, well, actually, you know, you don't really have to abide by the laws that you make. How is a citizen supposed to not take a look at that and come away saying, hey, the fix is in?
What do you think, Tim?
Well, it's an excellent question and reflects this overall problem of a perceived partisanship of the court. The interesting thing about courts related to this question is that when a court makes a decision like that, that decision applies as precedent for basically an infinite amount of time going forward. And so when a court makes this decision, it's not just making a decision in the moment in a particular case, but in that example, if we imagine a Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor, now the open meetings law also doesn't apply. And so even though we tend to think of politics in the moment for our own political priorities, courts have an implication with their decisions that go into the future indefinitely. And so it's not the case that, like a legislature, the legislature just changes their mind and goes against what they said previously. That decision stands as precedent for future decisions. And so I think the long view of those decisions are what courts are supposed to look at. Now, given your caller's question, I imagine that the caller disagrees with that kind of view where the court is actually just doing something to help out a Republican legislature, or Republican governor. But I think the interpretation of the open meetings law in that decision is actually one that is based on legal reasoning, and whether or not a person agrees with it, it's going to stand as precedent.
Thanks a lot for the call, Spike. One issue I don't want to miss out on, because it's been so important in the last couple of years, is civility and the breakdown of civility on the court. Obviously, some nasty comments we've heard behind the scenes, and then the allegations of a physical assault, back and forth stories from both sides, investigations into what really happened. And, you know, we had a Supreme Court justice on Tuesday telling me how she interposed herself to prevent a physical altercation between two of her fellow justices. What the heck?
Yeah, well, this is probably the most embarrassing thing that the court has had to face. Because it really is that outward evidence that there's a problem with the judiciary in Wisconsin. You typically don't want a court that is coming to blows over incidents. And actually, at the national level, the federal level, the justices famously get along across the aisle. So for all the differences between Sotomayor and the other justices like Scalia, they actually go on vacations together. They have trips. They go out for dinner. They think each other is very funny, and they enjoy each other's company. We don't see that on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And so I think one of the reasons for this is the partisanship of the elections. So these Supreme Court justices are actually representing the electorate when they're voted. Literally, they have been voted in by the people of Wisconsin. And so they are making decisions as representatives. Not always as justices, and that creates much more tension on a court than if we have appointees. And I think that really is kind of the institutional and structural reason why we see what we see on the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Something that each of the justices or candidates has said to me more or less is what I've asked them about civility and what they could do to help. They said changing one judge may not make that much difference. There's not that much they as an individual can do. But they all suggested that they could move things along and change the dynamic a little. How much can the judge we elect in April make a difference?
Well, a little bit of a difference. It takes the entire court to create civility. And so I think because we have kind of this history, one justice really wouldn't make a difference. But I think that the last year on the Supreme Court, last year and a half, has been sufficiently embarrassing that I think it really is up to all of them to change it. But realistically, changing one justice is not going to change the attitude of the court.
We had a caller on the line who couldn't stick around, said that they thought that the Prosser-Kloppenberg race raised the stakes, raised the partisanship level on the court itself, just because they were, I guess, watching it play out and it fed back into what was going on in their chambers. Do you think that's accurate?
I think it's accurate, although some of the things that happened that we talked about were prior to that race happening. I think the partisanship of the court was something that we've seen for a while before that race. I think that race was kind of the culmination of it in the sense that it became much more public and we could see it playing out. That's where these issues really came to the forefront. But that race really brought out what it meant to have a partisan court and what it meant to have elections for judges.
At the outset, and I didn't delve into it much then, you thought there isn't that much public interest in the race, at least not yet. Do you think we'll get more interested as it goes on, maybe after the primary and we have the two candidates set?
I think that there may be more interest. What I'm interested in seeing is whether or not the conversation comes to what it did in the Kloppenberg-Prosser race, which was that the Supreme Court really matters in Wisconsin, and many of the controversies that we have are also controversies about procedure and about legal interpretations and, like I said before, the powers of the governor. And so the outcome of this race is very important, and I think that as that conversation happens, I think there may be more interest in the race. I think one of the things to keep in mind about the race is that we're electing a justice for 10 years on the court. That means the justice will be sitting likely after Walker is governor. We may see the state legislature change hands a few times mm-hmm. in the term of the justice. And I think that shows how significant this race is. This isn't a short-term question simply about the policies of the current administration. This is a long-term question about interpretation of the law. And I'm interested to see if that happens because this is a significant race.
Time for one more call from Gary in Chippewa Falls. Hi there, Gary.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm real good. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is that we have, like, the legislature, the Senate, and the governor, and they pass a law, and it's all signed, and it goes into effect, and then it goes into the court system, and the court overturns it. And it seems to me that the court always has the last say. And I guess in relationships to a balance of power, why is that? I mean, it's like, why are they able to overrule what maybe what the people want and what our state legislature, Senate, and governor wants?
Tim?
That is an excellent question. And the answer to that question links back to the principle of the rule of law. So the question about whether or not a court should have power is really a question about who should be a final say in whether or not something is legal or illegal. And according to our both court interpretations but also Constitution, a court has a final say because it is the panel of experts, essentially, who get to decide whether or not something that a legislature has done is actually legal. It's possible for a legislature to break a law. It's possible for a governor to break a law. And who gets to decide when that happens? And it really is the courts. And it turns out that the courts are also responsible for upholding something like individual rights. When a legislature or an executive makes a decision against rights, it's really the court that has to stand up for people who are not necessarily in the majority. So those are the reasons, and it's possible to disagree with them because courts, by definition, are non-democratic in their decisions. But that's really the theory behind why we have a court and a separation of powers.
Just in our last 30 seconds, a couple of the big issues that you think might make it to the Supreme Court sometime after this election.
Well, you know, it's really hard to say, actually. I think we have seen so much activity with the legislature and the court. I actually wouldn't expect there to be too many really large issues that become very public. I think that the Supreme Court looks at so many different cases every year, so many details of cases and state laws, that I actually don't anticipate anything significant, but we'll definitely be watching because it's possible that we'll see fireworks in the coming years.
Tim, thanks for joining us again on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
That's Tim Dale. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour, Amanda Magnus for handling your calls. Thank you for listening. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network.